Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight my guests at the big table are legendary authors, professors, activists, radicals, and one-time fugitives. With that combination, I can only be talking about Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. Ayers just published a new book on Haymarket Books. It's called Demand the Impossible, and it questions simple ideas like education, health, healthcare, wars, and racism. But it also talks about hopefulness, imagination, creativity, and the other tools that we possess to fight back. If you're familiar with the names, it's history lesson time. Ayers and Dorns were part of the Weathermen, an activist group that splintered from the Students for a Democratic Society back in 1969. Their stated goal was to take on American imperialism and to protest the Vietnam War. A few years later, the group changed their name to the Weather Underground, and the Weather Underground bombed several targets, including the Pentagon. And Bernadine was put on the FBI's most wanted list. The charges were dropped against Ayers, but Dorn turned herself in back in 1980. She served some jail time. Since that time, they both continued activism, writing, and speaking while teaching at universities here in Chicago, Ayers at UIC, Dorn at Northwestern. Yes, they've been lightning rods from time to time. We see them show up in the newspaper, including Ayers' relationship with an unknown state senator from Chicago, Barack Obama. But for the most part, the couple continues to push for a voice for the voiceless. Bill Ayers is the author of Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and, of course, Fugitive Days, a memoir. And Bernadine Dorn founded the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern and has co-authored books with Ayers, including Zero Tolerance, Resisting the Drive for Punishment in Our Schools. They both live here in Chicago, and it is my pleasure to have them both on the big table tonight. Bernadine, Bill, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
Pleasure to be here.
That was a lot of words. All right, let's get to it. Demand the Impossible. What I really like about this book, and Bill, you've written a lot on these subjects, specifically that it's a blueprint for what we can do to change the situations.
What I tried to do really was to offer a vision of what we are fighting for. And, you know, I think that progressive people, all kinds of people, can offer a great critique of what's wrong with society. But in some ways, we need to step back and ask, well, what are we fighting for? What do we want? It's not just a complaint. In fact, there's a bumper sticker that I love that says, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention, which I think is true. But on the other hand, I always want to add a second bumper sticker that says, if you're only pissed off, you're not going to go anywhere. And so you have to have some sense of where you're going. So I make a plea in this book for unleashing our imaginations and getting out of the traps that are laid for us, the kind of narrowness of the debates, and saying, but what do we really want? And in that regard, the issues I take up, war and peace, mass incarceration, education, free health care for all, these are issues where I feel that even though sometimes we're painted as having extreme positions, I feel that we're in the majority and we should not be either defensive or elitist about it. We should talk openly.
These are issues, obviously all of these issues are issues that are playing out in the American election 2016 here, but it seems like more and more we're paying attention to who's delivering the message or character issues that are around the candidates. But there doesn't seem to be a deep dive on some of the things that are being talked about in Bill's book.
That's the dilemma of the kind of democracy we have at the moment. I think the electoral process dumbs everybody down. I know a lot of, certainly millions of women have felt sick the last several days because you can't get away from that kind of news. And I know before that, millions of people who've been insulted by the election process have felt both furious and despairing. But it's such an anemic form of the issue that we get in the electoral process that I think we're in the majority by saying we can't wait for it to be over. Because you right. actually... Nobody's really talking about war. That was even true when we had 15 candidates or 18 candidates. We're in a permanent state of war. And how did that happen? So I think that those questions about going deeply into the issues, people want that, actually. People do think about that. And it does matter to who we're electing, but it's not going to happen during the carnival time.
Yeah. Bill, you mentioned in the book, too, you talk about this concept as I think of so many voters who just throw their hands up right now and feel like they're disenfranchised or they say, you know what, I'm not voting for either. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing third. I'm just going to sit this election out. It almost is, and you kind of argue this point, by design.
Well, you know, voter suppression takes many forms, and felony disenfranchisement is one thing that I object to, but money in politics is a form of suppression. The kind of hateful campaigns that go on endlessly for years is a form of suppression. And I think what we want to do, I mean, I feel very strongly about not only the right to vote, but exercising my right to vote. But I want to expand that right. I want to say everyone should vote. Why don't we register people at the age of 18? Of course, we're here in Illinois, and thanks to the holdover from slavery, the Electoral College, our votes don't count anyway. So it's kind of pathetic. But, you know, I do urge people to vote, and I think that it's an important exercise. At the same time, I think what really changes things is mobilized people acting from below. And so while we can spend a lot of time, and we do spend way too much time staring at the sites of power that we have no access to, like the White House and the medieval auction block called the Congress, we don't spend enough time looking into the power that we have absolute access to, the street, the corner, the neighborhood, the workplace, the church, the synagogue, the neighborhood. These are places that we could be organizing, and we must be organizing if we want to bring about real change that will really make
a difference. Well, I mean, we've seen
lives.
That in Chicago in the last 6 months. Yeah, I mean, we've seen a pushback from communities, especially when it comes to violence or it comes to interaction with police, so the shooting of Laquan McDonald and protests. Is that what you're talking about? Is that what you're talking about where, I guess, the standing up and protesting can actually see some change in government?
Well, I think in government, but in life. I think that Chicago is such a yeasty place to be, and all of us are so happy to be here. What can you say? It's a great place. And, you know, I happened to be participant in the first huge immigration rights march that went from the West Side Park down through downtown. And I don't know if you remember, but it veered off one block over to Randolph to just pass the Haymarket
spot,
and then go back and come down to Grant Park. And, I mean, old people and children and millions of people suddenly seeing each other and realizing the potential power. I think that the movements that came off of that incredible day, both in terms of labor and living wage struggles, but also the young people standing up undocumented and unafraid. Who could have imagined that movement just 10 years ago, right? And that a lot of it would come out of Chicago and the very incredible kind of activism that happens
here. You know, when you talk about activism, and you have to bring up the fact that even on the other side of the aisle, when you talk about political movements, the alt-right movement and what we see with Donald Trump, that's a movement as well in the same spirit that you're talking about, where they want to take back their areas and be able to change the country towards what they want. I mean, do you see the sort of parallels to the stuff you're talking about in the book?
I do see that movements are what move things forward, and that's not lost on people, whatever their politics. But they can move things forward or backward. That's exactly right. But if you take a simple glance at history, you will notice that Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, was never part of the Black Freedom Movement. Franklin Roosevelt was never part of the labor movement, and Abraham Lincoln was never in an abolitionist party. Those three presidents are remembered for the great advances they made, but they were the result of fire from below. I often think when I see a textbook that says the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, unleashed decades of activism, they have it exactly backwards. Decades of activism led to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and that unleashed more activism. So it's people acting in, you know, from below, demanding justice, demanding more participation, more transparency, more equality, that really leads to change. Even in the Obama years, the people who made progress, Bernadine mentioned undocumented and unafraid, but think about queer rights. Think about gay, lesbian, transgendered rights. This is something that even a decade ago was unthinkable. And when Barack Obama ran for the presidency in 2008, he said that on the front pages of the Tribune, he said that as a Christian, he couldn't support same-sex marriage. 4 years later, Big Mouth Joe Biden jumped into the fray and said he supported it. Then Arne Duncan supported it. And my God, a week later, Obama supported it. But
Bill,
it wasn't.
Let's go back for a minute, because I think, you know, I think it's, there has always been in American life a nativism, a white supremacist, a propertied white male billionaire essence that hated on newcomers. That's a thread, an ugly thread, or sometimes even bigger than a thread of American political life. So in some ways, we've always had that, too, which is a call to purity, a call to white supremacy, a call to I don't know what, leave it to Beaver to the
50s. Well, and to define the other as the enemy.
And to always have somebody to hate on. Always right. have, and Scapegoat. Somebody to hate on, of course. It's always been African Americans. It's always been immigrants and newcomers. And it's always been women, for sure. So those are kind of longstanding forces at work in American life. And you can put your finger in any historical year and see it in full bloom. I think what Trump has done, and we've seen little shades of it in our lifetime, say with George Wallace, but this is a new bringing together of those forces where you don't disassociate from the Klan, right. nor from the armed
You've
militias.
Seen the Republican Party and more conservative factions in politics distance themselves in the past.
That's right. That's, so we don't these want forces, that, yeah, right. and they were separate. They were scattered. You know, they're armed militias in Nebraska and Kansas, and they're people who don't want federal land in the West, and they're people at the border. You know, so there's these kind of armed and militant, angry white men, and sometimes with other allies, who are a long thread in American political life. But I think Trump has congealed them and made them visible to each other. And it's more, in my mind, it's more like Europe now. We have a right-wing, neo-fascist hate force grounded in white supremacy and superiority and a longing for the past. You know, an imagined past, really.
Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers in studio with me tonight. Bill's got a new book called Demand the Impossible. Okay, so let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Big Table here on the Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guests, Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn. Bill Ayers got a new book, Demand the Impossible. We're talking about politics, movements, protest. Bill, I'm interested because I asked you this question last time you were in because I think we were right in the – I mean, it was before Laquan McDonald. It was right after Ferguson, and we had talked about comparing the protest movements of the late 60s to the protest movements of now, 2015, 2016. Has your answer changed at all as you've seen more and more of protests when it comes to police brutality or when it comes to African-Americans hitting the streets or if it comes to just the idea of mobilizing young people behind Bernie Sanders? Do you see a similarity, a parallel to what you guys were fighting for in the late 60s?
I don't really believe there was such a thing as the 60s. That's all myth and symbol. That's a product that's sold at the marketplace. No one looked at their watch on December 31st, 1969 and said, oh, nuts, it's almost over. We have a natural progression, and that's true of human beings as well as movements. And so what I see happening, and I feel also that the false comparison with young people 50 years ago and young people today is to say we had all the great music, we had all the great protests, we had all the great insights. Nothing could be further from the truth. Kids today are kind of diminished when that comparison is made. But I think kids are smarter, more informed, more engaged. And what's so hopeful right now is all over the place. And Black Lives Matter, I'll return to, but Standing Rock, the Native American protest, the prisoner's strike, the Republic Windows and Doors, the Chicago Teachers Union. We can point to the Domestic Workers Alliance. We can point to thing after thing that is people rising. And the Black Lives Matter movement is simply, I think of it as maybe the fourth American Revolution, but it's part of the centuries-long black freedom struggle. And the form that it's taking now is so brilliant and so exciting and led by 20-year-olds. And they're bringing us, they're illuminating not only police violence and police misconduct and the militarization of the police, they're also pointing to the connection between rotten schools and an occupying police force, between no jobs and a kind of repressive environment. So these kids have it all, in my opinion, and I couldn't be happier to watch as, once again, hope and history rhyme.
Well, I mean,
and here we are.
You could make an argument, you know, in 1968 that, you know, the movement of that time was run by 20-year-olds, you guys included,
right?
Right.
It always
the
is.
Idea. But, sure. but I mean, Bernadine, talk about that. I mean, what was it about the movement at the time, let's go back to the late 60s, that drew you in, that said, I want to be someone who's involved with this movement. I want to do something to enact change.
It was the Black Freedom Movement. There's no question. I grew up in a family that voted, my parents voted for Senator Joe McCarthy four times. I grew up in Chicago and then Milwaukee, went to great middle school and high school in Milwaukee. So I came from a totally, you could say apolitical or you could say backward kind of conscious family. But I was, you know, watching slowly, and watching and not doing anything, and watching and not doing anything. But I noticed that the students, for example, in Little Rock, who, you know, stood up to the racist mobs there, were my age. They were my age. I noticed that Emmett Till was my age. So some things didn't make me do anything. It just was little pinpoints in my brain. And I went to college, and I noticed Bernie Sanders was in my college class. I noticed that there was a sit-in at the University of Chicago over the fact that the university owned segregated housing. I didn't know how to join it. I wouldn't have even imagined joining it. But I did argue with people who thought it was a bad idea that they were right, and now we knew something about universities that we didn't know. But when Dr. King came to Chicago, I was just starting law school, and I said to myself, if I don't do this, I wasn't brave enough to go south, but if I don't do this, I'll always regret it. Hmm. And I hurled myself into his campaigns and his work on the west side of Chicago in Lawndale and Garfield Park. And as a law student, I wore an armband called Legal and was part of a campaign, a brilliant campaign, really, for habitable housing, for affordable, decent housing on the west side of Chicago. And so I got to learn from organizers who'd been in the South mm-hmm. and organizers who'd been doing welfare, women who'd been doing welfare rights organizing here, for how to do organizing.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's 50 years ago. I mean, that's this year, 50 years ago. But I mean,
it's
think about it. Let me ask you this for both of you who are involved in that. Like, I mean, do you see change? I mean, do you feel like 50 years when you think about it at where you're at right now in Hyde Park in 2016, that the movements of that time, the push to make housing integrated, to make it affordable, that it worked?
Yes and no. That's the amazing thing about struggle. You know, there's Miles Horton said that in the long struggle, there's valley times and mountain times. That was certainly a mountain time. So, yes, change has happened, and we can document all the ways in which it has happened, of course. The Vietnamese ended the Vietnam War, but then there was a 20-year period where the United States had serious constraints about war. Now we're back to permanent war. City of Chicago has always been segregated, but was there habitable housing? Was there struggles to have habitable housing? Those are never going to stop. That's an ongoing struggle. Well, I don't know about never, but you have to, I think, some of the same connections between poverty, white supremacy, and permanent war that were so apparent then are now so apparent again. How can we be at permanent war? How can the richest country in the world have one out of five kids going to bed hungry every night? It's so simple on one level. You just say, this is solvable. There's things in the human condition that maybe aren't
solvable.
And
Bill, you talk about that in the book. I mean, that's the one thing you talk about, which really kind of struck me, was you talk about the military and this concept that fill in the blank of who we're fighting, who we should be afraid of. Right. And the countries from 1968 to now, I mean, it's tremendous. The list is, it kind of makes your head hurt a little bit in the fact that you see it on page and you're like, there are 25 different names of countries that we were supposed to be afraid of at one point. Talk about that.
Well, I want to go also to this question of has anything changed? Because anyone who says nothing has changed wasn't there, because a lot has changed. And it's you know, all the changes haven't been good. The question that's underneath that question is, we've set out to end a war and then to end the conditions whereby war seemed so inevitable, and we did not succeed. We set out to end segregation in schools and to fight for voting rights, and we did not succeed. And it's worth noting that we didn't succeed in our highest aspirations because the struggle continues, not because we should be despairing or saying nothing changed. A lot has changed, and we can point to many things. I mean, the election of Barack Obama in 2008 was an extraordinary change, even though it wasn't the end of white supremacy, but it was an extraordinary step forward in a country with our sad and sordid history. So similarly, we were talking about gay rights. I mean, things have changed, right?
The lives of women have changed.
The lives of women have changed. And I think that's those things, you have to hold on to those things. But at the same time, Bernadine's pointing to the fact that, you know, there's a way in which we never get to where we want to go. You know, we never quite get there. And that's in the nature of having a vision of social justice, a vision of peace and democracy. You know, the great revolutionary Eduardo Galeano once was asked, well, you seem so utopian. What good is utopia? And he said, you know, when I take two steps towards utopia, utopia takes two steps away from me. When I take 10 steps toward utopia, it runs towards the horizon. So what's the good of utopia? And he says, it's good for walking. And I think that's true. And in some ways, that's the theme of the book. The theme of the book is we're walking toward justice and balance and freedom and peace. We're not there. And there's no kind of end point that you could say it's a product. We want it. We have to keep going and keep growing.
Let's take a quick break because I want to get an update on tonight's news. Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn in studio. Bill's new book is Demand the Impossible. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. I mentioned about war and military. We'll pick that up here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Bill's new book, Demand the Impossible, is out at Haymarket Books just this month. Let's talk about, I kind of teased it out about military and war. This has been something that has been at the core of your struggle for the 50 years. I mean, the Weathermen came out of this idea of American imperialism. American imperialism is referenced in this book. I mean, as we just referenced the idea of the struggle of the valleys and the mountains, when it comes to imperialism and war and your vantage point, where are we? There was a time, and you mentioned, Bernadine, where maybe we were drifting away from this idea, but it seems like we're right back in it.
Well, I don't think we were drifting. I think that the anti-war movement took the powers that be, certainly the military, by surprise. And the fact that, you know, not only did millions of people turn against the war in Vietnam, including, you know, impossible people to imagine, my parents and so on, but soldiers coming back who fought there, telling the truth, just tore the mask off of the notion that this was something that was a patriotic and good thing to do. I think that that's continued, obviously, with Iraq, with the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we have women soldiers coming back with more complex stories about what war really is and more memories and more tragedy, really, and insistence that this stop. So, yes, the war came roaring back at us with 9/11, and one thinks, really, that there was a program ready to go. So we had the Patriot Act, 300-page law, you know, on the table a week after 9/11. It seemed that it was there, ready to go. If we have a crisis, how can we use it? And you see that now, I think, around the questions of any violence.
I guess I think about it, and this just comes to my mind. I mean, I don't feel like there is much of an anti-war movement as there was, at least present, meaning you would see marches on Washington or things that were happening even in the 80s and the 90s when it came to wars. I don't know the last time I've heard of an anti-war protest at the Capitol building or anything about what's happening in Afghanistan. Why is that?
Well, I don't know all the reasons why that is, except that I would say that I think you can almost count on January 20th, an anti-war movement growing up and beginning to define the public space once again. I think the Occupy movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, Bernie Sanders campaign, and much else has led to the possibility of a real coherent social justice and peace movement growing up. But I want to go back just a minute because we had talked about some of the questions we would like to see the candidates asked. And a lot of what we talked about driving back to Chicago after that first presidential debate was questions like, would you, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, would you be willing to close all foreign military bases in your first term? Would you be willing to pardon Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Assata Shakur and Leonard Peltier? These are the kinds of things that we think ought to be in the discussion.
At least discussed. I mean, they could
say no, and then we'd be talking in a different register than talking about whether we need a safe zone in Syria. The fact is, and this is where the United States of amnesia kind of kills us, in reality, most Americans would like to live as a nation among nations. Most of us would like not to be a war nation. We would not like to be part of empire resurrected and willing to invade and destroy, including our own people and our own democracy. Most of us want that. But we never get to have that discussion because partly we just forget that The invasion of Iraq was a war of choice. The invasion of Afghanistan. In March 2003, the people who said, don't do it. If you do it, this is what's going to happen. Those aren't the people. I'm thinking of Professor Rashid Khalidi, for example, who predicted exactly what would happen in Iraq if we did it. Nobody's consulting him. They're consulting the very people right. who got us into the mess.
But on the flip side, and you'll hear this in the debates as well, that you know there's rhetoric around the concept that because we're not at war, warring factions, ISIS, others, are popping up and are wanting to destroy us.
But we are at war. We're at permanent war. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
But, you know, Bernie gets excited. Yeah.
We're bombing seven countries today, the United States, with no declaration of war. If you consider drones bombing a country, yes, accidents, of course, weddings, of course, civilians. It's inevitable when you're mm-hmm. up in the air bombing people. But, you know, yes, that's an invasion. If some other country was sending those kinds of weapons on United States territory, believe me, it would be war. It would
right.
be a declaration of war.
But in the
so seven countries, yeah. that's astonishing. And I have trouble naming the seven countries. I have to write them down because they come serially and there's no declaration of war. And, you know, Yemen, yes, we're arming, you know, Saudi Arabia, not just all the money and all the investment in Saudi oil and Saudi stability, but actually preparing the planes, Saudi planes, that are bombing Yemen. Why?
You know, this is what I mean, though, about memory. You know, it's the fact is that the invasion of Iraq led to the spread of al-Qaeda. The fact is that the invasion of Iraq and the spreading of war there created ISIS. So we're not innocent. And one of the things we have to remember is that when the American boot comes down, it does not bring freedom or democracy ever. It brings destruction, and the destruction gets back to us. You began this by citing something from the book about the notion that, you know, freedom and war are somehow linked. But it's just the opposite. My brother, who's a Vietnam era veteran, he says again and again, we should not be thanking the troops for our freedom. We should be apologizing the troops for sending them into harm's way for nothing, that in reality we don't gain from this. So we have to stop and take a look at what war brings to the rest of the world and to us.
I just want to say a strange, you know, who would have imagined that Colin Kaepernick taking a knee at the endless repatriation of sports in America? You know, you have don't just sing once, now you have to sing twice, and you have to stand up and watch National Guards and planes flying overhead during whirlies. What does that have to do with sports and pleasure in American life? It's why should it be militarized? And watching that kind of an individual gesture, become a social movement, is fascinating, isn't it? Fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Yeah.
Down
and it's
to
linked
kids
to Black
sports.
Lives Matter. It's definitely linked to Black Lives
well,
Matter.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because this country has had such a sordid past with movements and protests. And you guys were involved with one of the biggest that we've ever had, the protest against the Vietnam War. And I think that it is glorified in a way that you will see so many historical markers to it. You'll see so much throwback. I mean, even here we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the freedom movement and the freedom housing and so forth. And you'll see the images and everything about that. I mean, for you guys, thinking back to being a part of that and everything that came with that, whether it be the positives and the negatives obviously still follow you guys around. You know, do you feel like at the end of the day that you guys changed something, that you made a difference in protesting the things that you were protesting?
It's too soon to tell. but the one thing I'll say for sure is that I wouldn't want to be anyplace else. You know, one of the reasons that people get involved in movements, and Bernadine, I think you beautifully described your own being pulled into the Black Freedom Movement, but what you get involved because that's how you know who you are. It's not with a calculus of success. It's with a calculus of humanity. This is who I want to be. I want to stand against state executions of people, the capital punishment. I want to stand against, you know, mass incarceration. I want to stand for education and health care. Will I win? I don't know. Everything that happened in the 60s was prelude to what's happening now. I want to just follow up on the Kaepernick thing because Bernadine and I were a couple weeks ago at a family reunion in Ann Arbor with our whole family, and one of my brothers got tickets to the Michigan-Wisconsin game. So I, of course, put on my Kaepernick jersey and went in. And we,
of course.
And didn't stand for the national anthem. And everybody around me was, you know, kind of rude and strange. But with 4 hours together drinking beer, you become friends in spite of everything. But then later when I got home, they showed the beginning of the Michigan game, and the Michigan players were with their fists in the air, all the African-American players. And they, too, were caught up in the moment of saying, look, we're not saying that we're not patriotic. We're not saying we're not good people or good citizens. We're saying that at this time in history, we're going to take a knee or raise a fist on behalf of the movement for Black Lives and the movement that says we want an end to police occupation, we want education, we want decent lives for all of us.
I think it's astonishing, isn't it, that I'm wearing my Cubs T-shirt today, lifelong Cubs fan, 74 years waiting, hoping. I was at the game the other night. I never stand. I asked the people around me if it was okay, but you're always kind of unsure of what's going to happen. I think that those kind of, I can't imagine wanting to live a life apart from the struggle. I feel very lucky that I got to be with Bill for all these years. I got to have children. I got to have a life of work that was mattered to me. But a life where you were kind of waiting for election year to come to care about these issues, I can't even imagine it. So to me, it's just part of trying to live a full life.
Bill, you wrote your memoir.
You've
documented your life.
Yes.
Well.
Yes.
Bernadine, you haven't.
Mm.
And I've read some interviews just about the idea of why you haven't. I mean, a lot of people are interested in your story, being the face of the Weather Underground, the SDS, the movement, everything that happened to you, being on the FBI's most wanted list. Why don't you want to document that story and put it out for people?
It's too soon to tell. I might. I mean, I'm one of those people who lives with writers, right? And my son is a writer. Two of my sons are writers. Bill's a writer. I don't know. We'll see.
All right.
I haven't ruled it out.
But you want to, don't you?
I do want to.
Yeah.
Doing it and wanting to is another thing.
And when she does it, Justin, have her back on the show.
I feel like I'm busy living. What can I tell you?
Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers, my guest tonight at the big table. Bill's new book is out, The Man, The Impossible. Thanks so much for coming in. Nice to meet you, Bernadine. Bill,
pleasure.
Good to see you again.
Thank
pleasure,
you, Justin.
Thanks for doing this.